So this is a class on the seventh Vajra topic, the seventh diamond-like topic in the Uttara Tantra, which is what? The seventh one, enlightened activities, right? Oh, is that what you said? Enlightened activities. Like, what kind of activities does a Buddha do? Once you become a Buddha, what do you do? And some of you know that in the Buddhist text they say that every Buddha will go through the same set of activities. There have been many Buddhas who have come to the world in the past. The last one has been the guy called Gautama Buddha, Shakyamuni, and there'll be a future one who's called Maitreya, who's you. And when you come, and please do come soon, because I'm suffering. I need you to help me. So come soon. And when you come, you'll do a set of standardized activities. And those are called the set of enlightened activities. And this is a class on what those are. And there are 12 of them. People who've come late, just one last thing before I erase this, is that if you want to send your completed homeworks and quizzes that don't get completed before we all, go to different places, you can send it to me, and I'll correct them for you and send them back. This is class 10. The teachers got a partial translation of the reading for this class in this morning's email. So I think that reading will come to you someday soon, relatively speaking. And class 6 reading is here. So what are we missing? 7, 8, and 9. And 10, only some of us have partially. So, but all of that, I think, eventually you will see.
Is there reading for 5?
I believe there is reading for 5. Didn't people get reading for 5?
No.
No? Nobody got reading for 5? Okay. Which of his classes is he teaching this afternoon? Maybe that's 5.
Huh?
5 is this afternoon, so maybe he'll hand out the reading. We'll see. We'll go through the 12 deeds quickly and then go through them more carefully, at least some of them. There are a lot of questions for the homework for this class. I think there are like 10 or 11 questions. 12 questions. And the first question is just to go through what the 12 deeds are. This is a nice class because it's about the biography of... It's about your future autobiography, okay? It's about what you're going to do when you come as Maitreya, when you realize your Buddha potential, your Buddha nature potential, and you develop it by being compassionate to others, and especially that one special person who's been assigned to you in this teaching. Or maybe there's some of us have several, right? Who have had the assignment of bothering us, and making sure that we don't respond poorly so that we can realize our Buddha potential quicker. So these are the activities that you'll do. The first one is you'll come into our world from your staging ground. From the staging ground. Some of you know what that staging ground is. What is it? It's this heaven called Tushita. Tushita heaven. So when you become a Buddha, you'll go to this heaven called Tushita. This is another name for your pure land, your paradise, your Buddha paradise. What's your Buddha paradise going to look like for you? What's it going to look like for you? You can just go home and think about that. Mine's going to have a beach on it, I know. It's going to have really beautiful, slow-breaking, right-breaking waves. Perfect, easy, Hawaiian style, perfect waves. And everybody in it is just going to be having so much fun surfing. Okay, see? It's like it's going to be your paradise. So, you know, whatever it is that you think is beautiful and enjoyable and most pleasurable and stuff, that's what's going to be there. What are you going to look like? You know? It's like you can go and get your Vogue magazines now and start looking, page through. You want to be Brad Pitt? You know? That's who you'll be. Whatever it is, right? Whatever it is that you think is beautiful, whatever the beauty is means to you, is how you'll look. So that's what Tushita heaven means. And so that's the first act, is that from this pure land, you know, after enlightenment, you will become pure. your mind and body and your environment will become pure. And that will be Tushita heaven. And then you'll up there, you'll go, okay, next Maitreya, here, have my, you know, regent crown, you know, be the prince in waiting or the princess in waiting. I'm off. I gotta go. I'm going to emanate in Earth. Okay, so that's the first act, right? You take birth. You come to our world from the heaven of bliss. You come to our world from the heaven of bliss. The second one is you enter the holy womb of your mother. I'm just going to put it in the second person, the whole thing, okay? Because it's really important. You know, last night we were talking about it a little bit, like, well, you know, what are we going to take home from these 4 days? What are we, you know, what do we really take home from this? And one of the things that really I think we should be taking home from this is that it is possible for us to become Buddhas in this lifetime. Okay, we have the Buddha nature. We have the developable Buddha nature, and we have the inherent Buddha nature. We have the teachings. We have everything. Everything's here. So it's you that's going to be doing these things. So you will enter the holy womb of your mother. What form did the Buddha take when the Buddha entered the holy womb of his mother? Do you remember in the story? A white elephant with six tusks. Yeah, six. I don't know. Do you know why six, John? I don't either. Okay. And it happened like his mother had a dream, like she knew that it was happening and she saw this like white elephant. Or in the text actually that you'll get, they say blue, a bluish colored elephant. So apparently there are different traditions on what the color of the elephant was, which is kind of, one would like to know why an elephant and why six tusks and all these things. I don't know. And what was his mother's name? Do you remember? Maya. What does Maya mean? Is this Sanskrit class? This actually comes from the root, from a root that means to enjoy. Tushita. So Maya means what? Huh? It means illusion, right? Maya means illusion. So interesting name for a mother. We'll skip ahead a little bit in the life story of the Buddha. When the Buddha got married and had a baby, you know what he names his kid? Yeah. What does that mean? Do you know? Fetter, like ball and chain. Ball and chain. Oh my God. You know, I'm tied down by this kid. It can. That's right. It can mean it's a name for an eclipse of a lunar or solar eclipse. I can't remember. A lunar, I think. Lunar eclipse, because it swallows up the moon. Rahula is the demon that swallows up the moon, or something like that, in a lunar eclipse. But it means literally fetter, F-E-T-T-E-R, fetter.
And also the act of?
No, it just becomes a proper name for the demon that eats up the moon in a lunar eclipse. So anyway, you know, when you're thinking about like groovy Sanskrit names to give to your child, you know, you might follow the Buddha, huh? Sorry. Okay, so entering the holy womb of his mother. Third, taking birth from her womb. Again, in the story, when you are born from your mother, as Maitreya, you won't hurt her. Holy beings do not hurt their mothers. It's one of the features of holy beings. So some of you know that there are different kinds of ways to take birth. Different beings take birth in different kinds of ways. Why didn't the Buddha, would you think, why didn't the Buddha take miraculous birth, what's called miraculous or spontaneous birth, just like, you know, popped in? Why did he go through the womb birth, birth from a womb? Andrea, did you have an idea about this? Yeah. That's a good answer. That's a nice answer. To give Maya, the mom, the good karma of being the mother of a Buddha, which is awesome karma, right? Yeah? Yeah. Kind of. It, huh? Yeah. And so that he could, like, relate, so that we could relate to him. You know, if somebody just, like, pops up miraculously and, you know, and he's, like, all light and, you know, got, you know, rays coming out and stuff like that, we're going, whoa, you know, that's a person who's not like me, you know what I mean? And, you know, one of the things about these acts of the Buddha that you will go through is that we can start going through these acts now. We can start doing versions of these acts now. So one of the ways to think about the acts of the Buddha is, well, how can I imitate them now? And one of the ways to think about that in terms of this is to, like, you know, to try and take a form that relates to others properly, you know, so that you're not freaking everybody out, like, you know, I'm a Buddhist, you know, and you got, like, funny clothes on and, you know, wacky, I'm a wacky Buddhist and I'm not like you, see. The Buddha came in the form that he came in to emphasize the connection, you know, to make a connection with us, and to show us that we can be Buddhas too, because he's just like us. So a lot of these things have to do that. So, you know, think about it. Like, think about how to always, right, how to apply these teachings to your own life. You know, how can you relate better to those people in your world? And show them, you know, that you don't have to be, like, weird or wacky or speak another language or, you know, have a certain skin color or, you know, wear certain kinds of clothes to be, you know, to be in the Dharma and to be practicing the Dharma and to be trying to become Maitreya, which you will become. Yeah, Summer?
Are these emanation bodies we're talking about?
Yeah, this is the emanation body that you will take, because you're the first one was what? What was the first act, right? Right. Well, you were in the enjoyment body in Tushita heaven, right? Right. And now you've taken in Ramanakaya.
So you could technically be doing this once you have the darker chakra.
Well, we're going to talk about that. There are different interpretations of what we'll talk about. It. Was the Buddha already enlightened the whole time, or was the Buddha just got, like, you know, really good karma and then got born and then in this life, you know, worked hard and reached enlightenment through his own efforts? Yeah. So we'll come to it. That's the third one, right? Taking birth from the womb. From the right side, they say. From the right side of her chest. Okay, so it didn't come out in an impure way. It came out in a pure way. And no pain. Fourth deed, enlightened activity, right? Mastering the worldly arts. Those of you know, you know that he was born right into a princely family, into a royal family, right? A family of great wealth and power and so forth. And he was trained in the course of his youth in the worldly arts of the time. He mastered them, and there are actually some of them are listed in the reading that you'll eventually get. He learns to write. He learns archery. He learns swimming. He learns how to tame elephants. Those are the ones that are listed. The worldly arts. So in our day, you would learn, like, you know, how to read and write. You would learn how to communicate. You would learn how to do useful things to help you as the future Maitreya. Help others. Okay? Geshe-la sometimes says that we should be all the time trying to learn stuff. Anything, like how to fix furnaces or how to repair cars or something, because these skills could be useful to sentient beings, see? And that's the kind of idea here. Yeah. Okay, well, this is a good question. See, you guys are getting ahead of yourselves. Like, so wouldn't he already know, right? If it's an enlightened Buddha, like, why would he have to, like, learn anything? See, he's omniscient as an enlightened Buddha. So there are different interpretations of what's going on here. And one of them, the one that you would follow if you're following out your line of thought, is he's pretending. He's pretending to learn these kinds of... Why would he pretend to do that? Yeah, to show us that this is what we need to do. Right? So when we're budding Maitreyas, this is the kind of thing that we need to do, is to learn worldly arts so that we can help others, help communicate to others. Fifth one, enjoys himself with the queens. Okay? He gets married and he has a harem and he rocks and rolls, as they say. Why would this be an enlightened activity of a Buddha? The text says this. He wanted to benefit living beings in infinite ways, using even worldly activities to do so. Yeah, I will. And you should probably write it down. He wanted to benefit living beings in infinite ways, using even worldly activities to do so. Of course not. He was relating to sentient beings in a certain kind of a way. That's one way to think of it. From another point of view, okay? From another point of view, let's go down to a lower school point of view. Because we went up to the high school point of view right away with Teresa's question. This is just pretend. This is just make-believe. Buddha's just going through show. What about from a lower school interpretation? Buddha's not enlightened yet, okay? Buddha's still schmuck, okay? Buddha's not Buddha. Buddha's Gautama, Shakyamuni, just Siddhartha, regular guy. So why would... anyone read Hermann Hesse's book? Okay, really good book, okay? Really interesting book. And you can understand number, what is that, 6, 5? Very nicely through that book, Siddhartha. He had to sort of plumb the depths of kama, what's called kama, desire, in order to overcome it. And that's also, you know, kind of interesting thing to think about for our own lives. Like, you know, maybe we need to do at a certain point of our lives these kinds of things of, you know, getting married and having kids and making money and thinking, going shopping and going to the movies and so forth to get it out of our system. As long as you're thinking, you know, at some part in your head, you know, I'm exploring the depths of samsara, you know, maybe it can be a useful activity. Because maybe renunciation doesn't occur for many of us until we have explored the depths of samsara and what it has to offer. So that's from a lower school point of view. Yeah.
Just like number 4, spending samsara, especially that would be what's culturally expected of him as a lawyer.
Yeah, good.
You know, he doesn't go through that thing.
Yeah, right. You're some like weirdo. Don't be a weirdo. Yeah. And this is important, I think. It's important teaching. An important teaching for American Buddhists. Don't be a weirdo. It's the holy Buddhist activity of not being a weirdo and just being like regular, being a regular person in a regular, you know, and then secretly, you know, you're a weirdo. But but don't go like explicitly being weird. You're just turning people off, right? You're not relating to your sentient beings in your world, right? Yeah, these are the standardized list of every Buddha who's going to do this. You will do these. This is what... Get ready.
If you manifest in PMO form, I get to change someone who's around the world.
Excuse me?
If the future Maitreya manifests in a female body.
Oh, yeah. No, you'll make certain... As you're Maitreya, you'll make certain adjustments that need to be adjusted. If you decide to manifest as a female, you'll make a certain kind of adjustments. Yeah.
Making things contextual to how much time you want.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, unless you want to manifest in a culture that values elephant taming, right? Maybe you want to, if you manifest in a culture that values cars, for example, maybe you'd like to learn how to fix cars. So that, like, when you go driving home and you see somebody broken down on the freeway, you'll know how to help them. Number six, leaving the worldly life. So after, having, mastered these worldly arts and gotten married and having kids and so forth, number six is in the 29th year, in the story of Shakyamuni, in the 29th year, when he was 29 years old, he left. He kissed his wife goodbye. He kissed his sons goodbye. He said, that'll take care of you. I'm out of here. Okay? So this is renunciation. This is renunciation.
But he wasn't a deadbeat dad.
Right? He was not a deadbeat dad.
They were provided.
Yeah, of course. They were provided for. He made sure they were provided for. Of course. And, and he came back and helped them after enlightenment, too. They were among his first disciples. So, in his 29th year, the Buddhas, actually in the story that you'll get in the version of the story that you'll get in the reading, the Buddhas come to him. All the Buddhas, all the enlightened beings come and say, you gotta leave. Don't get stuck here. The next step is to leave. And so then the Buddha goes outside the palace for the first time. Some of you know the story, right? It's a cool story, really good story. The Buddha wasn't like us. The Buddha hadn't had a whole lot of time to get inured to suffering. And we are. We have spent our whole lives inuring ourselves. You know that word, inure? It means like figuring out a way to avoid the fact that life sucks. And we have done that very successfully. And of course, until samsara gifts us with the next disaster. But we're pretty good at like ignoring the regular course of disasters that are in our world. The Buddha had no experience of this because the Buddha, upon his birth, right, there were prophecies made. You remember what they were? He had two possible destinies. Yeah, it could be a Chakravartin. We talked about Chakravartins yesterday, right? A world emperor or an enlightened Buddha. When you're born as your Maitreya, your mommy and daddy, when they hear such a prophecy, they might say, better keep the kid at home, Better protect the kid from the world so that he doesn't renounce, so he doesn't leave us, see? So that he'll become like, or she will become like a successful politician, a business person, get an MBA, So they protected him. They cushioned him from the realities of life. And so then when the gods came in this part here, this is the sixth part, right? Six, leaving the worldly life. When the gods say, you got to get out of here, he leaves the palace for the first time. And he sees like what life is really like. And he sees four sights. And, these are three of these, all four actually, are ones that we see all the time. And we just go, oh yeah, because we're inured. But when the Buddha saw them, it was like the first time he had realized this about the way things are. What was the first sight? Sick person. He sees a sick person. He goes, what the hell is that? He's never seen anybody sick before. And in some stories, it's a charioteer who takes him out, right? And the charioteer is an interesting role. Like a charioteer is somebody who leads somebody from one place to another, right? So he's leading the Buddha from one place to another. He's leading from ignorance to knowledge, right? So he's, what's this? And the charioteer says, it's a sick person. And the Buddha goes, how'd that happen? Why? And the charioteer says, this happens to everyone. Yo, Buddha, future Buddha. Everyone's body breaks down like this at some point or another in their lives. And the Buddha just goes he's amazed, his jaw drops. He's like, how can people just walk around happy, oblivious when this is their destiny? So that's the first one. Second one, dead person, corpse, right? Is that right? Aging person, old person, and he's just like, what's wrong with that guy? He can't walk so good, he's all wrinkly. Can't see anymore, his teeth are all falling out, all these things gone wrong. What happened to him, What kind of unique thing happened to this guy? He goes, no, not unique at all. Happens to everyone. And again, the same thing, the jaw drops, how can people just walk around, complacent when this is their destiny? And third one's death, right? Sees a corpse. What, you know? And we're like this too, I think. If you've ever seen a dead person, right? If you've ever been encountered, you know, you go like, you know, you want to like nudge them and like, you know, come on, like get up, you know? We just, it's like, it's shocking to us that this occurs. So, and then the fourth one. The fourth sight is, remember what? Yeah, he sees a monk, a sadhu. He sees somebody who's trying for an alternative to sickness, old age, and death. So he leaves. Number eight. He comes to what's called... Undertakes spiritual hardships. He goes through his ascetic period. You will go through your ascetic period, where you will try... you will try different methods, one of which will be to get enlightened, one of which will be radical asceticism. Sometimes in the museums you see depictions of the Buddha who's like all just skin and bones, right? Totally, he's learned how to live on like one rice grain a day or something like that. He's mastered asceticism. And, you know, so there's a couple of different ways that we can take that. One is from one sort of lower school point of view, is that's the wrong way to go. That's the wrong way to go. That won't get you enlightened. That will make you just weak and unable to meditate very well because you're so worried about, like, because you're so hungry. So middle way, right? Middle way between the luxury that he lived in the palace and the radical asceticism that he experienced in his first stage of renunciation. That's one way to interpret it. Here's another way. To start doing the enlightened activities of you, future Maitreya, to persevere, to be willing to put up with hardships for the Dharma, to be willing to come for 4 days, you know, 12 hours a day and just like hang in and not get discouraged and not get tired and not say, to hell with this, I want to go home, and, you know, to work hard at it and to not give up. So that's another way to understand it. Eight, after this period of, you know, trying these kinds of wrong ways, he goes to what's called the seat of the diamond. It's one of your Sanskrit words, I'll put it up. Diamond is Vajra, and the seat is, do you know? Asana. Okay, so you got Vajra and you got Asana. So if you were going to say seat of the diamond in Sanskrit, how would you say it? Vajrasana. Very good. See? You're learning. So that would become a long A. That would become a long A there. Vajrasana. Okay? Seat of the diamond, Vajrasana. Asana means seat. Where's the seat of the diamond? Buddhgaya. Okay, Buddhgaya. And you will go to Vajrasana when you come as Maitreya. All the Buddhists go to Vajrasana. Now, whether Vajrasana will be in Buddhgaya, I mean, you know, it's an interesting kind of question. Do you have to go to, like, is Buddhgaya, is that place in India, Buddhgaya, exists from its own side, you know? See? You know, like, so... Maybe you'll project a different kind of Vajrasana, you see? It may not be there, you know, because there over there is just a projection anyway. You know? Huh? Sorry?
It could be
Howell
of New Jersey.
It could be Howell of New Jersey. It could be Tucson. Okay, so who knows? So come to the seat of the diamond, the heart of enlightenment, and sit down, sit yourself down under a Bodhi tree. Bodhi means what? Those of you, many got this wrong on their homework, so don't forget what Bodhi means. It doesn't mean Buddha. It means enlightenment. Bodhi. Enlightenment. That's, what's that Tibetan for that? Chang? No? Changchu. Enlightenment. Not Buddha. Enlightenment. So you'll go to the enlightenment tree, the Bodhi tree, and you'll sit down and you'll say, I'm not leaving here until I'm enlightened. In the reading that you'll get someday, you'll say something like, here on this seat, my body may rot and dry, my bones and skin and flesh may drop away, but until I reach enlightenment, I refuse to move from this seat. And you'll just sit there and you'll go into meditation until you get enlightened. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so you... That's interesting. So that's why it's that tree, probably. Nine. What happens? Do you remember in the story? As you sit there, what will happen to you as you sit there with this resolution? Okay, Mara comes. Remember who Mara is, right? Mara is the great tempter. Mara comes from the root mert.
This is a mer, which brings the word mrita.
This is that one, that vocalic R, mrita, which also brings the word amrita. Mrita means death, amrita, deathless. And amrita is also a name for ambrosia. In Tibetan, I believe it's called dutsi. Dutsi. Same word, amrita, ambrosia. So deathless. So Mara comes from that same word. Mara is sort of death personified, and is in the story of what will happen to you. Mara will come with a bunch of tempters, with a bunch of demon tempters, and you'll overcome them. So that's the ninth one, is that you'll defeat the demons. Demons always look, they're red and they have long tails, right? These are self-existent demons that exist. Who are demons? What do you mean by demons? Yeah, they're your mental afflictions. They don't exist out there on their own, out there, you know, self-existently, in any kind of shape, you know. They're what happens to you when that person that's been assigned to you over the last 3 days comes and bugs you, and you go, I'm going to forget everything I've been learning for the past 4 days and get pissed off now. That would be the demon inside you. They're obstacles. Then your tenth thing that you'll do is that you'll attain total enlightenment. You'll defeat the demons and you'll attain total enlightenment. Those of you know, this is the kind of total enlightenment that would be different from lesser nirvana. Our goal is not just to end our own personal suffering, but to achieve the end of our personal suffering so that we can really help other beings. This will occur at the age of about 35 for you. At the age of 29 for you, you'll leave the world. You'll renounce. And at the age of... So you'll have 6 years that you'll sort of goof around out there in the forest, you know, learning asceticism, showing perseverance to others. And then at the age of 35, you'll get enlightened. So then what are you going to do with the rest of your time? See, you got a whole lifetime then ahead of you. You're going to live till about 80 or so. Nice long life. And then you have a lot of time. So what are you going to do? In the story, you'll also be tempted to say, like, you know, nobody can really get this. This is too hard for people, for ordinary people. I spent so much time working at this and so forth, and I don't really think other people are really going to get it. And so you'll spend a certain number of, like, maybe about 49 days or so, like, just, you know, chilling and, you know, visiting all the kind of places in the universe. In the text, it says that. You'll go and you'll go on like a tour, you know. You'll go like on a cruise. You'll go on a cosmic cruise and you'll just check out everything, you know. Because you're omniscient now, right? So you'll just go, you know, what's out there, you know. Let's see everything. And then after about 49 days, somebody named Shaka, I believe that's right, Shaka, which is actually a name for Indra. Those of you who know, Indra, who's a Hindu god, usually, right? He's gonna come and he say, Maitreya, future Buddha, you know, start teaching. Please teach. No, this is in between. So the next one is 11. Is you're gonna start turning the wheel of Dharma. You'll start teaching. And you'll teach for 46 years. They say also, just, you know, back up for a second. The gods will beg you to teach mainly, it says in the text, okay, the reading that you'll get someday, mainly so other disciples would follow their lead. The gods will beg you to teach mainly so that other disciples will follow their lead. What does this mean? Will beg their teachers to teach. So don't forget. Always ask your teachers to teach. Always, 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 always request, at least mentally and better physically, verbally, please teach, please teach. Creates the causes for your own future teachings. And it's like built into this text. Did you get your answer? Question? Answer? Okay. And then finally 12. So then you do start teaching. You'll turn that's 11. Then 12 is you'll attain final nirvana. Final nirvana, which is called pari. Pari nirvana, final nirvana. At the age of 80. So I guess that means you'll die, right? Okay, good. You'll appear to have died. You'll appear to die. If you get enlightened, what is one of the, you know, the foresights include, three of the foresights include sickness, old age, and death. And the Buddha is said to have overcome sickness, old age. You will overcome sickness, old age, and death. So you're not going to die. It's all over. That dying stuff, that's old school. That's done now. So parinirvana is that you will withdraw your emanation. Sometimes they say it that way. It's kind of a nice way of putting it. You withdraw your emanation. Do you remember why, in some of the versions of the story of Gautama Buddha, why the Buddha pretended to die, withdrew his... Nobody asked him to stay. People forgot to say. People started taking him for granted. People started taking him for granted. Oh yeah, you know, the Buddha, he'll always be around. You know, oh, we'll always get these teachings. We'll always have Geshe Michael in our lives. We'll always, you know, have access to incredibly difficult Sanskrit texts like the Uttara Tantra in our own language. Well, that'll always, I just, you know, I'll bank on that, you know. It's my right to have that, okay? Don't think that way. Don't think that way. The emanation might withdraw. Yeah. Okay, so that's all question one, and we have 12 questions to get through. Okay, so yeah.
Beginning of the list, where does it start? Where you come into the world from Tushita?
Yeah.
That's when you've achieved enlightenment, or when you've achieved what?
Well, see, this is the same question. How do we understand what's going on here? Here's one way to understand it. You have created the karma, good karma, over lifetimes before this last lifetime, and you have, because of your good karma, got born into Shita heaven, and have gotten the teachings from the Buddha of Tushita heaven that bring you almost to Buddhahood. And then you're almost to Buddhahood, and you get a birth as a human being, which is the only birth they say that you can reach enlightenment in, as a human birth, and then you go through the rest of this stuff and you get enlightenment. So that's one way to look at it. That's a lower school way of looking at it. Then the higher school way of looking at it, you're chilling in Tushita heaven as a Buddha already. You're there. And you're in your Sambhogakaya. You're in your enjoyment body in Tushita heaven, which is going to have really good waves in it. And then you're going to say, I'm going to take a little break from surfing. Think I'll go down and emanate on Earth. You know, of course, they do this spontaneously. They don't even think about it. You don't even, like, it's not a plan. They just boom, and they go through this. That's another way of looking at it, different way. Second question. So this relates to your question. It's an interesting question, interestingly phrased question. What moves from where, but not from where, and for what reason, when the Buddha, when you undertake these 12 deeds? What moves from where, but not from where, and for what reason, when the Buddha, when you as the Buddha, undertake these 12 deeds? So here's the answer, and then we'll go through it a little bit. Due to your, I'll just say your instead of Buddha from now on, okay? Due to your great compassion, you look upon the suffering of the entire universe directly. Oh, as you look upon the suffering of the entire universe directly, your emanation body is sent from the enjoyment body to perform 12 deeds. But without you actually moving from the Dharma body. Dharmakaya. We'll go through these bodies in a second. So just get that all down. That's your answer.
So you're emanating in the last point in the Manakaya. That's your wisdom body.
Yeah. You never move from your wisdom body. Your wisdom body is unchanging and all like that. Is a Nirmanakaya a changing thing or an unchanging thing? It's a changing thing, right? It's a changing thing. Is a Sambhogakaya a created thing or an uncreated thing? It's a created thing. So you would say, you would also think that it's then therefore a changing thing, which then would mean under usual circumstances that it's an impermanent thing and wouldn't last. But this is an example, and there are some like this, of a created thing that, I guess you have to say changing but permanent. Moment to moment, the wave breaks. You know, it's the movie's on. The movie goes, the frames are still going. So it's a changing thing. But yeah, but it never stops. It's like the endless summer, you know, it's just one. it's a what do you call it, continuous loop or something? Yeah, Mobius strip. So let's go through these different bodies. Everyone get that answer okay? Sanskrit track, right? So that you'll know something more about what these. You already know the bodies, but now you'll know something more linguistically about what they mean. The first one is Nirmana Kaya. Say Nirmana Kaya. So Nirmana. See, good. That's where that's accented there because of the long syllable there. Nirmana. Kaya, see, like that. So that this is a big guide on how to pronounce Sanskrit. You always accent the long syllable if there is one.
And is it usually the same?
It's not. There's no rule on that. They can occur anywhere. This comes from a root. This is nir. You guys remember this prefix, right? From nirvana and other words that we've had here. What does it mean, kind of? Huh? Yeah, so it can mean to stop or without. It means a lot of different things. You know, let's see how this will work. That's the prefix. This part of the word comes from a root ma, which I wouldn't be surprised was related to the English word measure, because that's kind of what it means, to measure out. To measure out or to... You know, when you measure out something, it's also, you're in the process of building it. So this is the verb that can also mean to build or fabricate, to form. So the near here is like out, to form out. It means to form out or to build outwards. So nirmana means to transform. Transform. So sometimes you see the nirmana kaya as the transformation body, or sometimes they even say magical body, because you know you're appearing, you're building a body out there for you. You're appearing. Kaya means can mean a lot of different things too. Kaya can mean a trunk of a tree. You know it as body, but it can mean a trunk of a tree or the body of a lute. Like the main part of a lute, L-U-T-E, lute. It can mean, the principal thing it means is that an assemblage, something that has been collected, a collection. So it's also the word for like house, because house is a collection of rooms, right? It's a collection of parts. And body, guess what? Right, same. It's a collection of parts. Is your body. So, kaya. Samboga.
So, is that emanation or enjoyment?
That's the emanation body. That's the emanation body. Nirmana. See? Nir's a prefix that has all kinds of meanings to it, and I think here, trans. Our English prefix trans, T-R-A-N-S, because transformation is really literally what this word means. Nirmana, transformation. Samboga kaya. You know, Samboga kaya is usually translated the enjoyment body. This is the body that appears that you. This is the body that you are projecting in your paradise. So you know. Like Geshe-la and Christy are looking through Vogue magazine to see what kind of body they want to project in their paradise. That's a Samboga kaya. Samboga means enjoyment. It comes from a root bhuj, B-H-U-J, bhuj, with a sam prefix. Sam prefix means what? Who remembers? Like the English C-O-N, con, bring together. So you're bringing together in your enjoyment. So this is the word actually. This is the word that samboga can mean something like to eat together. The enjoyment that you have from eating together. It's also the word for sexual intercourse. It's one of the many Sanskrit words for sexual intercourse. There's a joke in graduate school I always heard that like every word has like 15 meanings. One of them will be sexual intercourse. It means to enjoy together. The boga part is the enjoyment part, and the sum part is the together part. So you could say, you know, enjoy together with all the other people that you're chilling with in your samboga, you know, kaya body in heaven. Or you can also think complete. Some can also mean, can emphasize the completion of the thing that it's attached to. So it's complete enjoyment. It's not like the enjoyment we have here, which is partial and fading and, you know, always like problematic in some way or another. This is like pure, complete, full-on, whole, 100% enjoyment. All enjoyment, all the time. Samboga. Dharmakaya means Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya, this actually has a technical meaning. It doesn't just mean that. It means the Dharmakaya means the emptiness body, right? The wisdom, they say wisdom body, but one, and they break down the Dharmakaya body into two parts, right? The what's called the
what's it called?
Jnana Dharmakaya. Jnana Dharma Kaya.
the Dharmakaya that refers to jnana, we had this word yesterday or the day before, wisdom. This is the body, the Dharma, part of the Dharma body that refers to the omniscience of a Buddha, right? And then what's called the Svabhava Kaya. Svabhava. Sva means self. Sva is a prefix that means self. Bhava means like being, the self-being, so essence. The essence. Svabhava is the word in Buddhist philosophy for essence. So they say essence body. What's the essence body of a Buddha? This is, we're still on question two, unfortunately. This is the part that you will not move from. The Dharma body, this is the part of the Dharma body that you will not move from, that will not change. As you're going through all these, like, you know, manifestations, ramifications, you know, you're over here being like, you know, Tom Cruise in Buddha Paradise, and you're down here being, you know, the next Maitreya and all like that. And then you're just, then there's part of you as the Buddha that's just there, always, unchanging, eternal. And that's the emptiness of a Buddha's body. Is the emptiness of a Buddha's body the same as the emptiness of us? Okay, that's an interesting question. Sort of yes and no, you have to say something like that. In a sense, yes, because all emptinesses have the same taste, right? So they are all the same, but technically no, because the thing that you are empty of is the, let's see, how to put this, the, you know, emptiness and dependent origination are like two sides of the same coin. You are dependently originating yourself as a Sambhogakaya Buddha and as a Nirmanakaya Buddha, and you are empty of having self-existence as a Nirmanakaya Buddha and a Sambhogakaya Buddha. Until we become Nirmanakaya Buddhas and Sambhogakaya Buddhas, we can't have the emptiness of those things. So the emptiness of that body depends, you could say, exists in dependence on being a Nirmana, having a Nirmanakaya body and a Sambhogakaya body. Yeah, and that's why it's on the Dharmakaya side of things.
The unshaped that we never move from this body, that's the whole Dharmakaya, right? Not
that's the whole Dharmakaya. That's just listed as the Dharmakaya. Okay, three. Why does Lord Buddha come to our particular realm? Why will you come to our realm? Why will you, Lord Buddha, future Lord Buddha, come to our particular realm? Why did the last one come here? Yeah, good question. Good answer, but wrong sort of way of thinking about it. The emphasis on the question is our realm, this realm. And here's the answer, and then we'll go through it a little bit. Because our world, which is technically the southern continent of Jambudvipa. And that's one of your Sanskrit vocab words. It's two words here. Jambudvipa. This is a long I. Dvipa. Okay? Jambudvipa. Technically, the southern continent of Jambudvipa, and more particularly, the central land of India, is a realm of deeds. They don't give the Sanskrit for this. I'm guessing it's... Karma Dhatu. Dhatu can mean realm. Realm or place. Like the desire realm is called Kama Dhatu. Desire realm, Kama Dhatu. So the realm of deeds was probably Karma Dhatu, where humans have a good intellect and are capable of renunciation. Jambu means a rose apple tree. John, you know what a rose apple tree is?
Yeah.
Okay. So, is it good? What does a rose apple look like? Oh, yeah. What color is it? Yeah, I think I've seen this. Yeah. Anyway, they call this continent Jambu. Dvipa means island or continent, because all continents are islands basically, right? Except for Eurasia. Well, you know, that's the only exception, I think, right? All the other Eurasia are two different continents. Africa is not quite an island, right? Africa is an island. No? Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's true. Almost an island. Anyway. So they call it Jambu Dvipa because it's an island where there are lots of rose apple trees. Yeah, where humans have good intellect and are capable of renunciation. Just quickly, this is off the off-road a little bit. This comes from the reading that you'll get eventually. But when you look down from Tushita heaven and try and decide where you should emanate, you'll have five ways in which you look on the world to decide. You'll look for the right place, and you'll find a place like this. You'll look for the right class of people to be born in. The Buddha, the last one, Shakyamuni, was born in the royal class because this was the most influential class at the time. The Buddha before that was born as a Brahmin because that was the most influential class at the time. When you're born, I don't know what it'll be, you know, like the Kennedys or the Schwarzeneggers. Or something. I don't know. So the right class of people, you'll look for the right clan, the right family, clan. You'll look for the right mother, and you'll look for the right time. And the right time occurs when there are what are called the five degenerations. The five degenerations start. Do you want to know what they are? Time of conflict, when there's lots of war and other kinds of conflict. When lifespans are dropping, when they start to drop, when worldviews are wrong, when mental afflictions are strong and last longer than they used to, when mental afflictions become stronger and last longer, and when beings become degenerate in the sense of their minds and sense powers are harder to rein in. This would be a really good time for you to come. Well, okay, from one point of view, you already did come, right? You're all already Buddhas, and thank you for coming for me. Four? Yeah.
You said central what?
Central, particularly the central land. Okay, so India is the central land of the continent of Jambu Dvipa. Question four, right? I'm going to move us along here, okay? So just write stuff down quick and hang in there. And then we'll be done on time, and then you can have a break before Geshe-la starts teaching. Four. According to some ways of counting the 12 deeds, the Buddha undertakes another deed before the traditional first, which is then combined with the second. So this is another way of like figuring out the pie of what the deeds you'll do. So according to some ways of counting the 12 deeds, the Buddha undertakes another deed before the traditional first, which is coming to our world from the heaven of bliss, which then combines with the second, which is to enter the holy womb of your mother. Name this new first deed. So according to some, you know, versions of what it is that you'll be doing, you'll take birth as a divine youth called...
Shveta Ketu.
Shveta. Say Shveta. Ketu. Shveta Ketu. Shveta means white. White. White color. And Ketu means like chief or leader. Can also mean comet or falling star. All of these come from the primary meaning of this word is bright appearance. So a chief or a leader has a bright appearance and so forth. So Geshe-la and Christie have translated this high white top. Your name will be high white top. Okay? And you'll be born as a divine youth with that name in the heaven of bliss, that is in Tushita or Ganden paradise. There you will teach the Dharma. And when you perceive directly that it would be of great benefit for all living beings, you'll hand your crown over to the keeping of the coming Buddha Maitreya, and you'll head for our realm. Shall I read it again? You'll take birth. I hope you're writing this down in the second person. You'll take birth as the divine youth named Shveta Ketu in the heaven of bliss, that is in Tushita or Ganden paradise. There you will teach Dharma, and when you perceive directly that it would be of benefit for all living beings, you will hand your crown over to the keeping of the coming Buddha, Maitreya, and you will head for our realm. Five. Okay? Okay.
Why are you teaching Dharma in a paradise?
Because that's what you do in your... That's one of the things that you'll do in your Dharma paradise. You'll have... You'll just be, like, enjoying yourself, like, 100% all the time. And one of the... It's very interesting. One of the things that you do in a Dharma paradise is to teach Dharma to 10th level bodhisattvas. But you're teaching them that in a Sambhogakaya, in a body of complete pleasure, which means that teaching Dharma will be complete pleasure for you. It'll be like better than surfing. It's part of the bliss that you will have is teaching Dharma. And those of us who have the opportunity to teach Dharma are getting some sense of this already, getting a little taste of it. There are Dharma, several Dharma teachers here. And you know how wonderful. When you see somebody, and I was watching in the crowd yesterday, you know, everyone here is advanced. But there are some people here who have not heard the pen thing before. It's amazing. Like, you know, we've heard it so many times that it's like, okay, pen thing over yet, you know? And there's some people, and they were just going, wow. And you could see, you know, that light bulb. And when you see that light bulb go on in people's eyes when you're teaching the Dharma, it's just like, it's bliss. It's kind of a bliss. So that in your Dharma paradise, you'll just be blissed out teaching, and you'll have like unbelievably good students, you know, who have all like been up there, who've gotten the karma to be in your paradise, right? They'll all do their homeworks and quizzes. Five, right? Give and explain the two well-known names that you will receive upon your birth. So you... You'll be called Siddhartha. Siddha? Artha. Say Siddha?
Siddha.
Artha. Now say Siddhartha. See how that goes? So you know, right? That this is a long A now. That'll become a long A because a short A and a short A have come together. Okay, Siddha. Siddha, some of you know this word, right? Like if you had a teacher who had achieved all kinds of tantric realizations, you might want to call that teacher Mahasiddha. Mahasiddha. Great. Maha means great. Siddha. Somebody who's accomplished something. Accomplished. That means Siddha means accomplished. Great accomplishment. The thing that a Mahasiddha accomplishes is called a Siddhi, which are sometimes called powers. They have amazing powers. They can read minds. They can fly. They can do all kinds of things, which are, you know, tricks. And in all forms of Buddhism, they teach it like that. Don't get hung up in the siddhas. Anybody can learn to do this. Not a big thing, you know. So, you know, when you start having them, if you're not already, I don't know. Don't think, oh, yeah, you know, I'm done now. I can read minds. Big deal, you know. Do something useful for the rest of us. Don't just sit around reading minds. Get in fully enlightened. Don't get hung up at that stage, see. So siddha means accomplished. Artha means goal or purpose. And let's see how they translate it. Yeah, wishes or goals. So siddhartha means someone who has fulfilled wishes or goals. So the prince is called Siddhartha, which means fulfilled wishes or goals, by his family, because on the day that he is born, on the day you are born, the people in your land are freed from all kinds of illness and trouble. Yeah, goal. End, or, you know, like something, an end. You're trying to reach an end. Goal. Purpose. Yeah, in your realm are freed from all kinds of illness and trouble, and things that they had been wishing for come true. Yeah, apparently, like, yeah, when you're born in Tucson, like, everyone in Tucson will have a really good day. Something like that, apparently. So that's kind of what it means.
Say Shakya.
Shakya. Muni. Muni. Say it together. Shakya Muni. Shakya Muni. Hear where the accent falls? Shakya Muni. Right? First syllable because it's long. Shakya means belonging to the Shakas. Shaka. Those people who belong to the Shakas become Shakyas. Shakya is his clan name. Shakya. The clan. He's named Shakyamuni by divine beings who come to pay him honor because all the rest of the Shakya people... Okay, so Shakya. Muni means somebody who's quiet, who's taken a vow of silence. A Muni is a silent sage. So why is he called Shakyamuni? Why will you be called Shakyamuni? And we can start, like, trying to live up to our future name. Because the rest of the Shakya people spend their time with meaningless talk and activities, while this particular Shakya proves to be wisely quiet. So while everyone else is out, like, blah, blah, blabbing, oh, what did Schwarzenegger do, and whoa, whoa, blah, 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 we will just be quiet and not engage in that kind of meaningless, divisive, useless talk. Six. Compare how those of the lower way, the greater way, and the secret way describe the level the Buddha was on as he went through the 12 deeds. So this is getting now at the questions that you guys were asking earlier. So who was this? What level will you be on when you go through these 12 deeds? I'll read you the answer in a second, okay? So this is not from the answer key, but this is from the reading. And it's interesting to know. And since you may never get the reading, who knows? Might want to write it down. According to the lesser vehicle interpretation, Hinayana, right? Lesser vehicle interpretation. That means the lower schools, Vaibhashika, Detailist school, and Sutra school. From the time of your birth in your previous birth to your birth as the next Buddha. From the time of your birth in the previous birth to the time of your birth as the next Buddha, you will be on the path of accumulation. Path of accumulation. From the time of your birth as the future Buddha to the time that you go to Vajrasana, the seat of the diamond, and sit at the seat of the diamond and not get up again until you reach enlightenment. From the time of your birth to the time you go to Vajrasana is the path of preparation. Path of preparation. When you sit down in Vajrasana, you start to go through the various levels of meditation. And one of those levels of meditation is that last one in the path of preparation, which is called something like, I forget what it's called, right? Yeah, it's called that, which is like the highest thing, right? The highest existing thing. It's also called something else like fire or tapas or I don't know. Anyway, so that'll occur. And then after that, while you're at Vajrasana, you will go through all the other stages, including the path of seeing, right? You'll go through the path of seeing. You'll finish the path of preparation. You'll go through the path of seeing. You'll go through the path of habituation. And you'll reach the last path, which is the path of what? No more learning. All in one sitting. It'll be a big day. You'll be really tired at the end of that day. Go home to the motel room and really crash out. So that's according to the Hinayana schools. And that's from your reading. So this question is, compare how those of the lower way, the greater way, and the secret way describe the level the Buddha was on as he went through the 12 deeds. According to the regular, quote, regular position held by those of the lower way and some of the higher way, the Buddha was a bodhisattva. The Buddha was a bodhisattva. And more specifically, either a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation or else a 10th level bodhisattva, according to different, you know, interpretations. He was a bodhisattva. Yeah, it means he has bodhicitta. And he's either on the path of accumulation, which means he has not had direct perception of emptiness yet, or he's a 10th level bodhisattva, which means he's just about a Buddha, during the first 9 deeds. Okay, right up to the defeating of the demons. Remember, he's in Vajrasana, he's in that, and he's meditating, and he defeats the demons right up until then, from 1 to 9. He's either a bodhisattva on the path of accumulation or a 10th level bodhisattva. And then up to the 9 deeds, through the 9 deeds, yeah. Through the defeating of the demons. And then, of course, what's the next one, right? Attaining total enlightenment. So what is he going to be? He's going to be a Buddha, right? And a Buddha during the last 3 deeds. Okay? Got it? So from a lower school point of view, which includes, I guess, some Mahayana schools also, seems to indicate that. This is who you will be up until level 10, up until deed 10. For the first 9 deeds, you'll be a bodhisattva, either on the path of accumulation or 10th level. And then after 10th deed, 10, 11, and 12, you'll be a Buddha. According to the special position, which is that of most texts of the greater way, the Buddha had long since become enlightened. Okay? Long since become enlightened. And only pretends to go through the 12 deeds for the benefits of disciples. And I think one thing to really, you know, to study in this class is to just to think like, well, and there's a whole question of this, so it won't be too hard. You'll get instructions. But to think like, how are those 12, what are these 12 deeds teaching me? What are they teaching me? What are they helping me to learn so that I'll, you know, now, as I'm trying to become the next Maitreya? Because that's, according to the greater way, that's why he did them, is to teach us something about something. So to teach his disciples. He goes through the 12 deeds for the benefits of disciples. According to the secret way, Lord Buddha appears in his enlightened enjoyment body as... Okay? So the Buddha, you, will take on the Sambhogakaya, right? The enlightened enjoyment body of Vajra. Vajra means what? Diamond. Dara means what? Holder, yeah, somebody who holds the diamond. Vajradhara is the Buddha in the form of Vajradhara, in the form, the tantric form of the Buddha, teaching the secret teachings. That's the form that the Buddha takes to teach the secret teachings, the form you will take. So you will appear in your enlightened enjoyment body as Vajradhara and various other forms located in this heaven. Akarnishta. Akarnishta. Hear that, like retroflex? S and T? Akarnishta. Akarnishta. Here is a privative, not. Kanishta means lowest. Youngest, it really means. Youngest or lowest. The word for youngest is the word for lowest. As some of you in your families know. not lowest. So highest. The highest heaven. So you will appear as Vajradhara and various other forms located in Akarnishta, the heaven below no other, below none, as well as in special realms around our world to give secret teachings. According to the secret way, you will appear in your enlightened enjoyment body as Vajradhara and various other forms located in the Akarnishta heaven, the heaven below no other, as well as in special realms around our world to give the secret teachings. So that's the tantric understanding of your acts. We have to sort of stick to the interpretation, to one or another of the interpretations, and not mix them. And I think that from the tantric interpretation, you will be teaching tantra to countless beings. From the lower, maybe even Mahayana, but lower Mahayana understanding, it might be different. I think it goes like that, and I don't really know, and we should sometime maybe ask. It's interesting, though, you know, if that's the case, then how come so many of us are getting tantric teachers? Hundreds, hundreds.
It's almost as if the realm that Maitreya is going to enter into is already a tantra realm.
Oh, I see.
Manifested in this dimension.
Right, okay, yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I'm not either. Yeah, Val? Okay. So, seven, right? There are two positions as to the deed the Buddha was performing when he attained automatic ordination as a full monk. Some of you know that this is actually in the old days, this was one way to get ordained, is sort of like automatically. The Buddha got it in one way, and we'll talk about that in a second. But apparently in the early days of the Buddha, one of the ways that he ordained people was just say, "You're ordained." Boom, boom, boom. Like, you know, no big ceremony, no nothing, you know, just like, boom, that's it, boom. That's a kind of automatic ordination, and then there's the, like, you know, you go through the stages, and you go through the ritual, and you do this, and you do that. So there are two positions as to the deed the Buddha was performing when he attained. So when did the Buddha become a full monk, I guess you could say? And how did this automatic ordination thing work? The detailist, that's by Bhashikas, say this happened when Lord Buddha left the worldly life. Which is which of the 12 deeds? Which number? 6. So they say it happened at 6, and he got automatically ordained. And I'll say a few things about what that means in a second, what the automatic part of it is. But that's what the Vaibhashika is. That's the stage, that's the deed that you will be doing when you get automatic ordination according to the Vaibhashikas. Some masters say that rather it occurred when you will reach the wisdom of no more learning. The wisdom of no more learning, which is another way of talking about what? Full enlightenment, which occurred at which deed number? Number 10. Here's how automatic enlightenment worked. Automatic ordination, sorry. Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? Automatic. I want an automatic enlightenment. That'd be better. Chakra. Chakra, I think, is Indra, again. Leads will lead you to a stupa, and you will cut your own hair off. You'll shave your own hair off, and Chakra, this god, will give you your robes. That's automatic ordination. Some deity, some high pleasure realm deity, not pleasure realm, desire realm deity, so not in Buddha or anything like that, but a very high desire realm deity will appear to you and say, come on, let's go to this sacred spot, and you'll, you know, bring, or there'll be clippers there maybe, probably. They'll be stored there somewhere. And you'll cut your hair off as a sign of your own ordination, and that deity will then say, here's some robes for you to wear. Automatic ordination. That's what it means. 8. Why according to the detail of schools? So now we're talking about, we're kind of like all over the place in this class a little bit, right? From school to school, jumping from school to school. So keep it straight, right? Keep the different schools' interpretations of these deeds straight in your own mind. So now we're talking again about the detail of school, the Vaibhashikas, lower school, Hinayana. Why, according to the detail of school, was Lord Buddha forced to endure 6 years of spiritual hardship as the seventh deed? Okay, seventh deed, right, is right after he leaves the world, he goes, you will go, and you'll do all these austerities, right? You'll learn all these austerities, and you'll starve yourself, and you'll do all these, like, yoga, and you'll sweat. You'll have all kinds of... tapas. You know, this is a word that Geshe-la was using in some of the quiet retreat teachings, I believe, right? In relation to... Not in relation to yoga, even before that, yoga teachings, I think. Tapas is hardship. It means hardship. Being the ability to put up with hardship for the Dharma, especially for spiritual goals. It comes from a word, tap, from a verb, verbal root, tap, which means to heat up, heat. So it's very, very similar to the Tibetan idea of tummo. It's ascetic heat, spiritual heat, inner heat that you get from doing certain kinds of practices, especially austerities. So what's up with this? Why did the Buddha, why will you go through this stage where you do this kind of tapas? So according to the Vaibhashikas, they say it was a karmic result. This is interesting. They say it's a karmic result of you having spoken badly of the previous Buddha. So it's a kind of a karmic payback. It's a bad thing. You have to go through, because you're on the wrong track, see, also. Right? According to this idea, you spend 6 years wasting your time, basically, on a wrong track before you, like, wise up and figure out that this is not going to get you enlightened. Okay, so why? How come that happened to you? How come that will happen to you? So they say, well, it's because of some bad past karma that you had of talking bad about the last Buddha. And that Buddha's name is Kashyapa.
In our case, who knows?
Who knows who our previous Buddha was? Could be our teacher, you know? The higher schools, okay, so now here's the alternative explanation. The higher schools say that that statements in the original sutras to this effect must be taken figuratively. So the higher schools say, no, not quite. That's a metaphorical statement, not literal. Why, according to the higher schools, do you think, did the Buddha undergo this stage? He's already enlightened. So let's say from the higher school point of view, he's already enlightened. Why would he go through this stage of like pretending to like go, you know, to like be confused about how to get enlightened and to try all these like wrong techniques and to do this? Yeah, partly to show us that they're wrong, of course, right? And to show us, right, that this is not, that's not the way to go, but also to emphasize this idea of perseverance. Like, you know, this is the kind of stuff that you have to be willing to put up with. You have to be willing to have this kind of determination and perseverance if you're going to, you know, reach the goal. 9. Name the 4 demons that are defeated as the ninth deed. Name the 4 demons that are defeated as the ninth deed, right? The ninth deed is the defeating of demons. And describe a position of Jetsonkapa on when they are actually stopped. Okay, so these are these demons that come as part of the army of Mara. And, you know, they do all kinds of stuff to the Buddha. They try and shake the resolution. They will try and shake your resolution as you're sitting down and have vowed not to get up from meditation until you reach enlightenment, going through all the stages. And they do all kinds of things. You know, you've heard the stories. They come and they shoot arrows at the Buddha, right? They will shoot arrows at you. And what will those arrows look like to you as they're coming towards you? Yeah, flowers. They're just like, okay, that's the emptiness of an arrow. The emptiness of an arrow is that, you know, if you collect the right kind of karma, people can shoot what they see as arrows, and they'll just appear like bouquets to you. Okay? Then, you know, dancing beautiful maidens and what's the male equivalent of a maiden? Brad Pitt, beefcakes. The dancing beefcakes and maidens will come trying to, you know, test you, right? Lust. And you will see them as bags of rotten guts. That's what it says in the text. You'll look at them and you won't see, you know, Brad Pitt or, you know, whoever. You'll just see like, you'll see like, you know, what they look like, really. Underneath this thin veneer, what we really look like. Filled with, you know, you'll do that like instant meditation that sometimes they give you to do of like what's inside there, you know, pus and blood and, you know, snot and... All right. So the first is the demon of the mental afflictions. The demon of the mental afflictions. So that, I guess, is the one that has that red tail and has a pitchfork and, you know, those demons. The demons of mental afflictions. That, I think in the story, actually, it, you know, see if you think, this is just my own speculation, okay? That is the name of the demons that come and shoot the arrows. Because they're angry, right? They're anger. They represent anger. Hatred, right? So that's the demon of mental affliction, which according to a presentation by Jetsonkapa, is defeated at the 8th bodhisattva level. Okay, so the demon of mental afflictions is defeated at the 8th bodhisattva level. You're at Vajrasana. You're in deep meditation. You're going through all the levels now, right? Boom, 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 boom. And at the 8th one, you defeat them. Next is the demon of death, according to the same presentation. The need to die through karma and mental afflictions is absent from the first bodhisattva level. But since one still takes rebirth up until Buddhahood, then it can be said that this demon is not defeated until then. Okay, so I'll read that again. Next is the demon of death. According to the same presentation, the presentation by Jetsonkapa, the need to die through karma and mental afflictions is absent from the first bodhisattva level. But since one still takes rebirth up until Buddhahood, then it can be said that this demon is not defeated until then. Then the third demon, the demon of what's called impure heaps. Not defeated until full Buddhahood. And the demon of impure heaps is not defeated until full Buddhahood too. Then the demon of what's called divine youth. The demon of divine youth is a destructive spirit who obstructs the final defeat of the other three demons. The fourth demon is the demon called the demon of divine youth, who is a destructive spirit who obstructs the final defeat of the other three demons. So when's that demon defeated? Yeah, also only at enlightenment. What?
Well, you're saying that you can't, the yearling in view, that you have to defeat the demon of divine youth in order to defeat the demon of impure heaps. And Buddhahood happens in an instant, so you can't be doing two things in an instant. Well, if one of them depends on the other.
If one of them depends on the other, then when the other is defeated, then that one's defeated too. So this is the third one, right? The third one helps prevent the defeat of the fourth one helps prevent the defeat of the demons 3 and 2. So if demons 3 and 2 aren't defeated until enlightenment, then the fourth one's not defeated until enlightenment too. That's all it says. I would suggest that the impure heaps demon is those temptresses and tempters, the Brad Pitts, the beefcakes, and the dancing girls that come, and then you see them. You see them as impure heaps. You see their bodies as impure heaps. That's why they're called impure heaps. I'm guessing. 10, right? Are the 12 deeds of Shakyamuni Buddha? Are all the 12 deeds of Shakyamuni Buddha performed by Shakyamuni Buddha? This is one of those like trick questions. What do you think? Under any school point of view. Pretty good answer. I guess I shouldn't have said that so quickly, under any school point of view. Let's say from the lower school point of view. Okay, from the lower school's point of view, which is that, you know, this bodhisattva was born, you know, in his final birth, in your final birth, and all like that happens. Then stuff like that happens. Are all 12 of the deeds all 12 of the deeds of that last birth of the Bodhisattva soon-to-be Buddha, are they all the acts of Shakyamuni Buddha? Are they all the acts of the same person? Are they all the acts of the same birth, you could say? Yeah, right. You have to, like, what about the first two, I think, right? Technically speaking, the first two deeds of coming to our world from the heaven of bliss, that's one, right? And two, entering his holy mother's womb, are deeds done by the person who was to become Shakyamuni Buddha. It's a little technical question. It's a form of rebirth still. You're still in the form of, you're still you as you were in your last birth before this last one, in the previous birth before this last one. Okay, this is the last, I think the last question, almost last question. Yeah. Technically speaking, the first two deeds of coming to the world, coming to our world from the heaven of bliss, that's deed one, and entering your holy mother's womb, two, deed two, are deeds done by the person who was to become you as Shakyamuni Buddha. Okay, this is a really important question. So we're almost done. There's only one question after this, so concentrate on this one. This is a really good one. Speculate a bit on how each of the 12 deeds may represent a message from Lord Buddha to us on how to conduct each stage of our own life over the course of our life. So how did these 12 deeds, what was the last Buddha trying to teach us, future Buddhas, with these 12 deeds on how to like get closer to being the next Maitreya? So here, listen. Deciding to come to our world, okay, that's number one, right? Deciding to come to our world can represent the decision to get involved in helping others in an ultimate way once we have seen their suffering. That's why the last one came, because the last one saw us suffering and said, you know, I feel so sorry for them. I have great compassion for them. I want to help them. I mean, another way to think about this question is, how can we start like now? Take the result into the path, right? How can we start now to do the acts of the Buddha in our world, in our lives, to do the enlightened activities? So start by getting involved in helping others in an ultimate way once we've seen their suffering. This means like cultivating bodhicitta, really. Cultivating that urgency to get enlightened quick so that we can truly help others in the ultimate way. Entering the womb and taking a human birth, deed two, right? Represent the decision to take on a form that other people can relate to in order to teach them. Okay, and this is what I was talking about before, like the holy Buddha practice of not being weird. You know, to the best of our ability. You know, it's going to be a trick for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean, though, right? No idea.
As opposed to egocentric. Yeah, I mean, there is an egocentricness, I think, to, you know, to like purposefully unconventional activity, of just like being in people's faces about how different we are. You know, oh look, you know. And it's not really compassionate in a way. Mastering the worldly arts. That's three, right? Mastering the worldly arts could represent our worldly careers. Okay, let's stop there. That's not the end of this sentence, okay? I bet you can figure out what the end of the sentence is. But anyway, let's stop. Wait, before we go there. So what could we be doing? So this is like, how could we think about our worldly careers differently as enlightened, as pre-enlightened activities, you see? Yeah. Oh, didn't I do that one? Entering the womb and taking birth. So two and three are together. Sorry. Yeah, I didn't make that clear. So mastering the worldly arts could represent our worldly careers. So, you know, how could we make our worldly careers, if we are in a career, how could we make them pre-enlightened activities? Like to see them as skills, you know, as opportunities, as skills for our practice. Instead of like, I'm in a career to get ahead or to, you know, fulfill myself or, you know, to get better than others or to get a lot of money or whatever, to see it differently, to see them as means for helping others. Okay, here's the rest of that sentence. We were talking about renunciation last night, right? Mastering the worldly arts could represent our worldly careers, which we must sooner or later leave behind. In case you were wondering, you know, we didn't kind of do the full-on thing last night. You know, it was a little bit like, you know, not so skillful, but anyway, means of just like sticking at one level and saying, you know, oh, you know, you don't have to quit your job and you don't have to do this. You don't have to, you know, you can have renunciation and still lead it or another. At a certain point there, you know, you just don't have time. At a certain point, it comes down to like, you know, I don't have time to have a career and a family and a this and a that and get enlightened in this lifetime. And that's the bottom line for the, you know, the advanced students, okay? The bottom line is that, you know, at a certain point, you got to fish your cup bait, really. Geshe La says this, you know, rarely. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, I think in class, course 6, Diamond Cutter Sutra maybe, there's one or two classes in the ACI curriculum where he just pulls it out and says, okay, look, I'm taking the gloves off now. Here's the real dope. You don't have time to mess around with a career and a family and a car and this and that and this. Okay? You gotta, at some point, you just gotta say that, okay, I'm out. I'm done. I got a different career now. I renounce. And that's, you know, renunciation starts with a mindset, but ultimately that's where it ends. The spiritual hardships, right? Is that right? Oh, the same with sensual pleasures, yeah? The same with sensual pleasures, especially sex in a mundane married life. Okay? Especially. The same. Is there any ambiguity about that? Yeah, the same. It means the same. It's sooner or later, we must leave them behind. The same with sensual pleasures, especially sex in a mundane married life. Yeah, both. The spiritual hardships. Okay, that's number. What I've lost the numbers here, but you know what it is, right? Renunciation. The spiritual hardships show us that enlightenment is won only with hard work and many pains, especially if we are not careful in the path we choose.
Mastering the worldly arts.
Yeah.
Okay. Number five was enjoys himself with the kings or queens.
Yeah.
So that has to do with the sensual pleasures.
That has to do with sensual pleasures. No, that's sensual pleasures. Especially sex in a mundane married life. Leave that. Got to leave that. Sooner or later, leave that behind. Then spiritual hardships.
What happens with leaving the worldly arts?
Well, that's what you do with number four and five is you do number six, is that right? Leaving the worldly life is what? Yeah, is six leaving the worldly life? Okay, six is what you do in relation to four and five. Yeah, but six is, what do they call it? Six is called renouncing, right? Renunciation? What's the deed called? I can look, I guess.
Leaving the worldly life.
Leaving the worldly life, okay? So, yeah, it's renunciation. So six means, yeah.
No more queens.
That's
no more
exactly. Okay, you're right.
You didn't talk about like what number five, what worldly, what being number five in our daily life, number five being enjoys themselves.
It says, well, okay, I'll spell it out. It means like, okay, once you've done that, then at a certain point you got to stop doing that, and then you got to do number six. And that's
so,
what we can learn. If you are doing these things, then you need to go to number six, eventually.
Number six?
I mean, you're asking me to extrapolate because I'm just reading you the answer key, but that's how I would extrapolate it. That's what is meant here. Number four is, you know, maybe necessary. Number five may be necessary. You as Maitreya maybe need to do these things. But you also got to, like, say, at a certain point, number six comes next.
Okay.
And you can't just sort of skip number six. See, that's the thing. This is the one that we would really like to just, like, leave out, maybe. Couldn't I just, like, do all that other stuff except for number six? And it's not like that.
Because
you don't have time. You can't, there's not, yeah, it's the bottom line. The bottom line is that enlightenment will take such energy and such commitment.
And this life is so short.
And this life is so short that it's impossible, really, ultimately impossible to try and serve two masters.
So basically number four and number five are doing compatible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a way of learning how to help people as part of the path. Understanding is part of the path. Okay, we got to move, right?
Can you say six?
Six? Six is included, okay? Six is included in these two sentences. Listen to these two sentences. Mastering the worldly arts, number four, could represent our worldly careers, which we must sooner or later leave behind, six. The same, six, with sensual pleasures, five, especially sex in mundane married life. The spiritual hardships, seven, right? I got the numbers right now? Show us that enlightenment is won only with hard work and many pains, especially if we are not careful in the path we choose. Eight, coming to sit at the Buddha tree, Bodhi tree, right, is like that personal sense of responsibility for the enlightenment of all beings and the decision to work to the death, if necessary, to achieve enlightenment. Remember that resolution that he made, that you will make. when you sit down at the Vajrasana. I'm not getting up here. I don't care. Like, my body can die. Everything can, you know, my body can deteriorate. I'm not leaving. You have to have that kind of resolution. So coming to sit at the Bodhi tree is like that personal sense of responsibility. Those of you who know, this is Laksam. Laksam, what? Namdak? That thing right before Bodhicitta, right? It's my job. This is my personal responsibility to get all beings enlightened. And I need to do everything, whatever it takes, to get enlightened. That's what that Vajrasana, sitting down at the Bodhi tree thing, can mean for us. Defeating the demons is a statement upon who our real enemies are. Is my enemy Saddam Hussein, you know? Who's your real... Is the enemy the person that's been put in charge of bugging me at this teaching, you know? Who are the demons? Defeating the demons is a statement upon who our real enemies are, our own mental afflictions. That's one demon. Death itself. Any state of mind or body short of an enlightened angels. Okay? These are all demons. Any state of mind or body short of an enlightened angel's mind or body is a demon. And anything that would hold us back from our task. Reaching the state of enlightenment is a statement to us that it is possible to be of ultimate benefit to all living beings. The state of enlightenment, that's the 11th deed? Reaching the state of enlightenment, the 11th deed? No, 10th, right? 10th deed is a statement to us that it is possible to be of ultimate benefit to all living beings. Teaching others the path is the highest form of help we can give to others. Okay? I'm going to read that one again. Because there are people in here, our Dharma teachers, and there are future Dharma teachers. And that is the highest, that is the best thing that we could be doing. Teaching others the path is the highest form of help we can give to others. You know, if you have to choose, okay, should I help somebody, you know, who's poor get more money? Or should I teach the Dharma? You must teach the Dharma. That is a higher calling. I mean, in these kind of like Sophie's Choice kinds of situations, you only have a certain amount of time. There's only a certain amount of time that we all have. And this is the highest form that we could be doing, the highest form of assistance. So next time, you know, a Dharma teacher is like, you know, next time you're all like bugged about your students and, you know, it's a big pain in the ass and you got to go to the Xerox store again and, you know, nobody's helping you and all like that. Just remember. Remember that one. And the fact that even Lord Buddha passed away from this world is a reminder of how fragile we ourselves are. Okay, that would be a lower school understanding of what this activity, enlightened activity of the Buddha means for us. Parinirvana, passing from this world is a reminder of how fragile we ourselves are. And also, okay, kicker, a reminder that many of the things we see around us may not be at all what they seem to be. Did the Buddha really die, you know? Did the Buddha sit on some deathbed going, you know? Or was that just an appearance and was the reality different from what it appeared to be? And maybe there's lots of stuff like that going on in our world all the time. 12. Question 12. Last question. When Lord Buddha came out of his holy mother's womb, he took 7 steps in each of the 6 directions of space. When you're born in your last lifetime, you're going to be a remarkable infant. Okay, you're going to come out. Your mom's not going to have any pain, and you're going to come out and you're going to start walking around and you're going to take 7 steps. And each time you take a step, lotuses are going to appear, and lotuses appeared below his feet with each step. And he made a high proclamation, and you will make a high proclamation in each direction. Give the famous line that you will speak as you step to the west. Very close. Yeah, very good. John's got it. I am the highest being to walk on this planet. And just like for your information, among the other things that you will say is you'll say, this is my final birth. I'm almost done. Now I will rip out from their roots the experiences of birth, aging, sickness, and death. Yeah, that's the answer to the question. Period. You don't have to know the rest. Do we have to know this? But that's what you'll also do. You'll be ripping the roots out of birth, aging, sickness, and death. And Geshe-la always likes to like emphasize the death part, okay? Buddhism is teaching, has always taught, that the goal is to end death. Is to end the experience of death. We're done. Class 10. Thank you so much. This is really fun. And thanks for putting up with the Sanskrit and stuff. It's great that I could do that for you. All right, so we'll dedicate a little bit. Sunam yeshe jumbe tabak.